Welcome to the Winners and Losers radio program. We broadcast on www.enlightenradio.org. You can also access us via player.enlightenradio.org. And we have a list of podcasts that are published on, well, two places, actually. One, podcasts.enlightenradio.org, and also on democracyroad.podbean.com. So if you want to listen to any former shows, well, we're doing about five shows a week now, but they're short, shorter than we used to do. And I think short works better for podcasting in general. It don't take up quite as much of people's time. Anyway, this morning I want to welcome a good friend and our former state senator, a pastor of three, I guess he's still three. I don't know what the state of these parishes in West Virginia, in Harpersbury may be. Three parishes in West Virginia, I think a Lutheran, Methodist, and Episcopal, if I'm not mistaken. So John Unger has played an important role, both in the care of this community and representing it in the state legislature for a long time. I'm glad to have him here. On many fronts, I've always enjoyed talking to him. And, I was a student of philosophy at one point, way back. And John has a strong interest in ideas all the way across the spectrum. So welcome, John. It's good to see you this morning. I know it's early, but welcome to our program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I jokingly told you that you purposely put it at 7 o'clock because your guest has very few excuses. Look, I have a meeting at 7. It's a conflict. Few meetings at 7, right. So I think it's a good time, but also it's a good time when people are driving to work and getting ready for work or getting ready for their day.
You can listen to practically any of your devices now in the car. It used to be, if it was an AM or FM, you couldn't do it, but now things have changed. As long as someone can find your address. Well, I was going to talk this morning. I know we had a conversation the other day, but I was going to. I've been reflecting a little bit on the discussion we were having about the gun violence situation, especially since it seems to be picking up in frequency. And after we had a conversation, I had a program. You know James Boyd, right? His nephew, who lives in New Jersey, was on the program with him, and a very thoughtful guy. Ex-military, and I think a firefighter, and a solid citizen, really, in a very. But he said, he had a suggestion that it's beyond the capacity of police to actually, be in a preventive capacity in this problem of, school and workplace violence. Very different beyond that. And you really need a way for the community to, play the role of security, because if you don't have the security, you're going to seriously undermine the public institutions and school systems and, a lot of things. But that the police come, usually, after, the only thing left to do is to kill the perpetrator. And, which is a little bit weird, because we don't get to, I wish they didn't have to kill quite so many of them so they could examine and find out, what's really going on with some of these situations. But I thought he had a very interesting idea of how the community, especially veterans, including, retired officers and stuff like that, could play a role in presence at the schools or at some institution where there was fear. And And I thought that that was an interesting and play a preventive role, a presence anyway, that law enforcement could not do. I know you mentioned the other day that to me that you thought the whole issue of the gun violence thing might, because of its very difficulty of dealing with it in the ordinary political process, at least right now, might be a distraction. And after I remember after we hung up from you, I said, well, that, you know, I mean, obviously, if your kid's going to get murdered at school, that's going to distract you. But then I thought, well, you know, I've seen these movies occasionally, you know, where if you want to free your buddy from jail, you start a fire at the other end of town, you know, and you go in and, you know, while the sheriff's down dealing with the fire, you go in and rescue your buddy from the jail, you know. And I've seen even much darker mysteries where, you know, a targeted murder driven by a very material self-interest of taking over someone's property or business or whatever is covered up by having random serial killings, okay, in which to mask the you know, the motive behind the crime. And then it occurred to me, actually, I woke up from a dream about it. And not about it, but I kept thinking about, well, maybe, you know, somebody is playing a very serious game of driving up the level of violence to distract from something else. And, you know, because I have a hard time buying the fully random theory. So anyway, I thought your thoughts were to believe me a thought, but I was going to give you a chance to either plow further or weigh in on, is this whole issue from a political point of view a distraction? And is there anything that comes to mind that we can do to meaningfully improve the data on all these stuff that's happening with guns and shooting? Anyway, enough of me. Welcome, John.
Yeah. So I mean, let's take a look at that as far as gun violence. You know, out of that alone, we focus on the gun, and I'm not saying that, you know, yes, guns are used for violence, but I think the root aspect of what we need to get to is violence in general. Is other types of violence being also increased along with using guns. I mean, is there domestic violence? Yes, that's increasing. Is abuse and neglect of children increasing? Yes, violence against children. And so you can name a whole host of things. But of course, what I was saying is that people like to debate over the gun, because that's a very charged discussion. Particularly in America, and it has been for a long time, and it also makes a lot of money for a lot of organizations, one side or the other. You know, the pro-gun folks, the anti-gun folks, driving the population to really get in a fighting mode for that, and it makes a lot of people wealthy off of that debate, depending on which side you're on, and it divides us. But the one thing that that won't divide us is that we need to do something about the violence. And what is that? I was involved with Kettering Foundation that did a lot of deliberative dialogues. I was a scholar in residence with them for some time, and on their national issues forum. Institute was on their board, and they do deliberative dialogues. And I did a couple deliberative dialogues on guns, gun control. And so when you know, people thought, oh my goodness, John, you're gonna get caught in the middle, and it's just gonna be a terrible situation. And I thought, well, maybe, most likely, but I had it, because we needed to have it. So you had one side, you know, yelling at those who were more pro-gun, Second Amendment rights, and those, you know, those from the anti-gun or the gun control folks yelling at the Second Amendment rights folks saying, you know, you are a bunch of thugs and, you know, pistol packing, you know, and you're just, you want to kill people. And, you know, all these accusations going back and forth. And then the other side, the Second Amendment rights to those who are in gun control, you're a bunch of communists and you want to take our guns and our freedoms and our Second Amendment rights and, you know, and all this other stuff. So back and forth. But after it was all said, when you do a deliberative dialogue and you unpack it, what happened was both sides of that issue, those individuals, no matter where you stood, found out they had a common concern. That a common aspect of that issue. And what it boiled down to is both sides were afraid. Fear of violence. Mm-hmm. That's what it came down to, fear of violence. See, those who were gun control advocates felt that if we could control the guns and get the guns out of everybody's hands, I mean, if that's a possible utopia world, if that could be the case, then you feel safer. They would feel safer. Right. The Second Amendment rights folks says, you know, what makes me safe is if I can protect myself. And so right. If you take my protection away, that elevates my fear, and therefore therefore that's how I approach it is I want to be able to have the agency to protect myself. But they both looked at each other and say, you know, each of us are afraid. We're afraid of violence. So I think that what I was trying to communicate to you in our conversation kind of offline was that, you know, we're talking a lot about guns, but we're not talking about the root causes of violence. You know, what causes us as human beings to have such a violent nature? And why is it, or is it really increasing? I mean, I know we're getting a lot more media coverage, but let's look at the data, because violence has been around for ages. I mean, you just, if you ever watch or if you look at documentaries or read, you know, your history, you know, violence has been around for a long time, in the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, whatever you want to call them, but even beyond that. But what is predicating the violence in humans, and how do we address that? See, that's a tougher question. It's a lot easier to look at other types of objects or other types of reasons and say, okay, we're going to solve this problem by, you know, by creating a law or restricting this or somehow.
Right.
But, you know, the tougher question is looking in the mirror and saying, you know, what is it with us that's causing this type of violence toward each other? And then you get into, you know, mental illness. You get into anxiety and fear. You get into, you know, a whole host of very dark and ugly things that people don't really want to examine or reflect on themselves or on others, you know, in society, because it's a much harder question than the debate of, you know, about guns.
Right.
So that's what I was trying to communicate to you, was that we spend a lot of energy and time talking about an object, okay? And we don't do enough time talking about the humans, ourselves, what predicates it. So that's what I was trying to. So, you know, I'm not trying to minimize that debate at all, because it's an important debate, but I just think that we're not talking about, you know, why do these individuals take anything, a gun, a knife, you know, a club, you know, any type of, or even their own hands strangling people or poisoning people, you know, whatever the method of violence is, we don't talk about that. We talk more about that object.
You know how it's, when I was growing up, you know, my dad was from, Abilene, Kansas. And, he used to tell us, you know, he loved to tell Kansas parables, you know, to try to instruct you about various things. And I remember sometime in the 50s, it must have been that, the TV show, or maybe it was early 60s, Dodge City or Wyatt Earp with Hugh O'Brien would come on, you know. And I would ask my dad, I said, so, you know, it looks like, you know, you couldn't bring any guns into town during the roundup or when, you know, all of a sudden Dodge City changed from a little farm town to a commercial center, you know, with all these things, all these people riding cattle 1,000 miles because they could find a railhead and actually sell it for something and send it to Chicago, right? Beef. So, you know, but it didn't look like he killed many people. Mostly people were drunk and he hit him over the head with a pistol that was really more like a, you know, a garden tool, a long barrel. But I said, Dad, well, you know, well, that was Dodge. I thought you were raised in Abilene. And he says, well, that's true. He said, we had a harder time. We decided at one point, he's telling stories told by his grandfather. They decided to hire Wild Bill, you know, because when Abilene, you know, which was farther west than Dodge, became the latest railhead facing the wilderness, right? And they hired Wild Bill Hickok, but they had to fire him because, you know, he couldn't stop drinking on the job. And when he pulled out his pistol trying to do something, he kept hitting innocent bystanders. So I always thought that those two stories were kind of a parable of both police violence, ordinary violence, gun violence, that if you could just keep them out of town when people get riled up and hot, when they're in, you know, when the humans are in close contact and the commercial interests because of the interest of property, I mean, the interest of, you know, survival in a sort of fundamental economic sense, are at stake. And, you know, conflict will take place there. Whether or not I don't think there's probably no way to stop it there. But the problem now, in my view, is that the world is so interrelated and interconnected that nations, you know, don't, for millennia, you know, if you wanted to solve a problem, you solve it by domination. You know, if you wanted to solve a security problem or a security problem related to an interest, well, if you wipe out the opponent and you win, you write the history, okay, and problem is solved. But now we have this situation where, you know, mutually assured destruction starts to play into so many conflicts and interests, and it seems to me like the powers in the interest of cooperation and of less inequality, you know, which always creates a huge argument about justice. I feel that, you know, we have to come together both in our communities and our and nations, too. That's all.
Well, so, John, that's a good point. So guns have been with us for, you know, since our history, our entire history. So, and what is it that's making, what is it that's creating the fear today that, say, wasn't 20 years ago or 30 years ago? Maybe there was, but, you know, I know when I was a child, you know, I used to ride my bike across Martinsburg, you know, I lived on the other side of town, and I would ride my bicycle to my grandparents' house, which was on the other side. You know, so we lived on the south end, and my grandparents lived on the north end, and we could do that. You know, and I was a child to do that. today when I talked to parents, they wouldn't dare let them just ride down to the 7-Eleven, you know, right. Or to, I mean, you know, it there's no longer, you know, there's a fear to even walk in the evenings, downtown and things like that. So, see, we got to ask the question, is it because of guns that people are afraid of going downtown or walking? Well, that may be one thing that comes to mind, but it's how people are reacting to each other. And I would submit to you that I think the increase of fear and violence that's happening in our society, it's not only this, but again, it comes down to mental illness and drugs that could be codependent on each other. I mean, it drives people to do things that a normal state of a person wouldn't do. And so these are the root causes of violence that causes the fear. So, I mean, these are tough issues that, you know, if there's a real big debate going on is, you know, what are we doing about this? And the pandemic has only caused more of this to happen.
That's for sure.
Because of isolation, because of disconnection. You know, the idea of social capital, Robert Putnam talks about this in his book that's about 30 years old. It's called Bowling Alone, where it used to be people came together in bowling leagues and came together in rotaries and came together in church or other social gatherings. Mm-hmm. But now we're relegated to our iPhones, to, you know, in our homes, and it creates a sense of isolation that then predicates, again, increasing fear and mental and also mental health. Works on the mental health. So these things, if you ever watch Social Dilemma, the documentary on Netflix, talking about social media's impact on the division on people and their minds, all these things. Bill Bishop wrote a book, dated again, called The Big Sort, talking about how technology is sorting us to a point where we no longer have to interact with somebody who doesn't believe exactly what we believe or think the exactly way we think. We can spend our whole life watching television that feeds our own thought right. processes, looking at media, social media, right. listening to things and being in our gated communities or in our homes where we don't even know who our neighbors are anymore. Our next door neighbor, we don't know who they are. That wasn't the case back when we were children. You know, the whole community knew each other and had some types of interactions. So, you know, these are things that have predicated, have increased violence, because when you isolate and you dehumanize people to a point where they become objects themselves, and that, you know, you even look in our education, you and I talked about this, yep. you know, Robert Putnam talked about, wrote a book about our kids, and it said in the 60s when parents used to say, let's do something for our kids, they meant all the children in that community, you know, let's do it for our kids. Today, when someone says, I'm going to do something for our kids, they mean their children. And so you're seeing the split going from public education, where people used to focus on what's best for the community, to more private charter schools, what's best for my kids, you know, and granted, a parent ought to look after their children, but not exclusively, because looking after your children is also looking after the environment that your children is going to be in.
Don't you remember
that's created
yes.
a situation where it's fertile ground for violence.
Don't you remember when Hillary got in so much trouble for suggesting that it takes a village to raise a child? You know, when
well,
you were saying,
I think that wrote a book on that, but I mean she didn't coin that. That's an African proverb.
Okay, but I remember they gave her a hard time.
It was much more ancient than Hillary Clinton. Yeah. Hillary Clinton got in trouble for a lot of other reasons, and it didn't matter what she said. Someone was going to criticize.
It just didn't work.
It takes community.
Right.
It takes community. If you want to look at it from a theological point of view, even the scriptures talk about this, where there are two or more gathered in my name, Christ will be present. You know, the idea of the Trinity, it's God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, three in one, community. I mean, you look at all the aspects. Jesus sent out disciples two by two, community. You know, not individual. And so all this is predicated on our human DNA.
Yeah.
Our nature is that we are creatures, social creatures. And that if there's things that interrupt that, the number one crime, if you commit a crime in prison, what's the number one, what's the most severe punishment that the prison can put on an inmate that creates a crime in prison?
Isolation.
I mean, they could add more time, right? But what is it?
Isolation.
Yeah, right. Right? So what is that? Oh, that's stuck in the cell by yourself. Okay. Well, I can handle that to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
But then it starts playing on your mind.
It does.
And so if you are isolated, mental illness starts coming in because we are not built for that. And if that's the case, then of course you're gonna react. You're gonna act out the anger, the resentment, that all those types of things, and you'll grab. You know, it's just those are that's what predicates violence.
Let me.
I'm just saying we ought to get to the root cause of that. Get to people and. You know, I'm not saying don't have the debate about guns, but we spent a lot of time on that, and I'm gonna tell you. At the end of the day, it's not necessarily going to decrease violence.
The other point that is worth saying is that nobody disarms until the peace treaty is signed. And that's
a power thing, John. Yeah. You keep in mind, you know, there's two ways of, you know, the idea here, the theory is that if giving a person agency and if you come to negotiations, you know, if each of you have something that the other person wants or is concerned about, then you'll most likely negotiate in good faith because you have mutual benefit in the sense
mutual
of
interest,
doing so.
Yes, right.
It's called kind of a social contract.
Right.
The idea is that, but if one of the parties come at a weak state, you know, where the other party doesn't need anything from that party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Then there's no sense. There's no benefit to the one that has the strength to negotiate with the one that. So instead of taking the power away from the individual that has it, we need to start lifting up other people to have more, more in a sense of equality of power.
And that's
with any negotiation.
Right.
You know, if you're wanting to buy my house and I need the money to, you know, for that purpose, then you and I will sit in good faith and negotiate, you know, what's a fair, mm-hmm. What can we do? You know, I want to sell my house, but I need money to go do this. And you want to buy my house, but you don't have a lot of money to spend. Okay. Well, let's come and negotiate because we both have something that each of us has in hand. How can we exchange that in order for us to get a win-win?
Well, you also have to convince people that there's some justice. I mean, I negotiated many labor agreements, and you know, nobody ever wanted to settle before the last minute, or even 20 minutes or half hour after the last minute, because you had to persuade people who were going to be unhappy with some aspect of the result that nothing had been left on the table. That whole kind of thing. So, yeah, I understand. But let's take a few minutes. Thank you for your remarks on the gun violence situation, or just the violence situation, the way you put it, is important. And, you know, you have to, you know, before people will surrender violence to the monopoly of the state, which is the foundation of going around disarmed, you got to have peace. You got to have agreement. You got to have some consensus, and you've got to find the mutual common ground, or it has to be found. Sometimes it can be found through exhaustion, like in 1865. I want to move on a little bit, because I know I'm fascinated, and let me just say that there's a tremendous amount of interest in the labor movement right now in the recent mostly energy-related investments coming into the state via the Inflation Reduction Act, and efforts of Senator Manchin to get the Nucor battery plant for electric cars going, and the cooperation that's been going on with United Mine Workers on that facility, and also the hydrogen hub, which I learned more about from you than I've heard from anybody recently, actually, because you have some background with this. And also I used to work for Microsoft for a number of years, and you're not everybody whose name was William or Bill that worked for Microsoft. If they were Bill, they had to change it to William, because there was only one Bill in Microsoft. And that was Bill Gates. Anyway, and so, and he paid a personal visit to the state also. He doesn't usually waste his time, that fella, and on converting some existing coal plants to nuclear facilities. So anyway, this is a big thing involving a lot of money, and I was hoping you could help shed some light on where you think the best interests of West Virginia might be served overall with these big investments that look like they're taking place. What do you think?
Yeah, so I used to work for the National Energy Technology Laboratory in Morgantown for a number of years. Many years ago, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, something like that, 15 years ago, maybe. And they were working on this hydrogen energy at that time, the NETL, both there's a facility in Morgantown and one in Pittsburgh or outside of Pittsburgh. So what I understand with the H2 hubs is that it's up to an $8 billion grant, a cooperative agreement, and recipients of that grant could be any type of industry, universities, national laboratories, local governments, tribal governments, environmental groups, I mean, community-based organizations, to really set up a program in order to demonstrate the production and processing and delivering and storage of end use of clean hydrogen as an energy source. And so I believe that they're looking at what are called regional clean hydrogen hubs. And those would be like around $7 or $8 billion to establish either 6 or 10 regional clean hydrogen hubs across America. And what I understand from your conversation, West Virginia is in the running to be one of those regional or one of those regional hubs, which does not surprise me, because the NETL has been researching this for a long time. Like I said, when I was there, they were doing a lot of research and testing and aspects of it. So this has been in the works for a long time. And they say that, these investments will create good paying jobs, improve energy security. And the fact of the matter is, we're not dependent on a resource that will be depleted, although it could be challenged, but water, is a resource that's you know, particularly in West Virginia, we have a lot of that resource. And that caused me, my work at NETL at the time, and I was a senator, I said, you know what, we need to start protecting our water. And so that pushed me in setting up that movement, the West Virginia State Water Protection Act, and other things. And people were saying, well, what's the big deal protecting our water? And I said, it's coming down the pike. I mean, I can see this as more valuable, water being more valuable than our coal or gas, natural gas, or even oil. Because first of all, water is life's, you know, needed for life sustaining, because we all need water, every living being, every living thing. And the second is it's a renewable energy source if the research is there. And so, and West Virginia has a lot of it. So it could very well, West Virginia could very well continue to be the energy source for the country, as we are now under coal, but we could do that even with water. So this is a move in that direction. And again, I don't know all the details because I've not been involved with these particular discussions, but it comes out of the Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations, and it was part of the infrastructure bill that was bipartisan infrastructure bill that was passed. Basically started moving forward with that, and I think it's to decrease our dependency on oil. Which you start off the show by saying Saudi Arabia, that China has gotten Saudi Arabia and China or
in Iran.
And Iran to sit down. Well, I think that, you know, that's a little disturbing because we get a lot of our oil from Saudi Arabia. So I think that if we can harness our water to make energy, then, you know, and become less dependent on Saudi Arabia, I think the better off we're going to be. We're less dependent on anyone outside of our country, you know. We're going to be better off.
Well, now that I probably don't agree with that last part. I mean, I think that getting along and depending on each other is probably the foundation of sustainable peace. And so I'm... You know,
it goes to my argument of the mutual power thing, and that's
okay.
True.
Well, mutually,
when it becomes energy source, I mean, I'm saying, you know, less dependent, not independent. Again, you want to come to the table with some type of mutual agencies, you know, power set of exchange. So. But particularly if there are areas that are sworn enemies, you don't necessarily want to give them the upper hand in the negotiation.
Why are they a sworn enemy, China?
I think mostly on their part.
Really?
I mean, Iran. Well, when let me put it this way. So when I served not in the military in Iraq, but I was in both Iraq wars as a humanitarian worker. Mm. And I remember the second Gulf War. I was in the areas of Karbala and Najaf, which are the holy cities of Muslim holy cities. And I remember at that point, of course, you know, Saddam's administration had been defeated. There wasn't really civil service as such, and the Americans came in and with some United Nations help, setting up civil government. And I remember that young Iranians, which were they were in civilian clothes, but supposedly they were soldiers, and they were migrating in and settling in Iraq at that time by droves, migration that actually Iran had programmed to send them across the border to do so. Mm. And just the interaction, just looking sometimes when they would, you know, individuals, they would look at me with, and I could see it in their eye, although they did not do anything, the anger and the hatred, not towards me personally, but toward, you know, as what they've been indoctrinated as far as America, you know, as Americans. And I think that it's, you know, I think that governments can put forward propaganda. We're just as guilty of it as what they would be in things. But, but they, you know, China and Iran and some others have declared America, you know, as Satan or the, you know, and I've heard the same rhetoric on our end toward them and so forth. So it goes back and forth. So it, that's what I meant by, the governments being, put forward in the population as sworn enemies.
Well, the other, my other concern about the energy developments is that we, you know, we, some find a way to avoid the curse of natural resources, or the course of any, actually any sort of monopoly, single, you know, an industry that, that stands in the way of diversifying the economy, or that stands in the way of, you know, single interests, or a combination of energy interests that have a lot in similar, owned by out of state interests, et cetera, et cetera. And I want us to be like Norway. You know, I don't want us to become Norwegian, but, although I have some very good, I have a good friend that's Norwegian, but if the state through sovereign wealth funds or various kinds of, you know, instruments can find a way, you know, so that the profits from, or the gains from the energy industry, whether it's extractive or the hydrogen concept, which is not exactly extractive, you know, we're not losing, like you say, we're not losing our water, but it could be vulnerable to some of the same economic trends where all the money, so much money heads out of the state, that West Virginia continues to be the poorest or the second poorest state in the country, despite possessing immense wealth. And that's, how do we get out of that trap? You know,
not, recording stopped.
So. Don't listen to that little recording stop, and that's the AI. I have another recorder. I didn't ignore that. Anyway, so that's actually my last kind of. We bring this to a close in a minute, but you know, how do we avoid the curse of natural resources? If we have all this natural wealth or energy production, how can we get up from the bottom or near bottom of the poverty traps that are here?
So I mean, you and I talked about that earlier, not on this show, but so if you look at a lot of the natural resources rich countries, a lot of times they're third world, they're underdeveloped or developing countries. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the other countries come and export their natural resources and then add value to it, turn it into products or energy or some aspect of it. You know, natural resources are placed, I mean, we utilize natural resources for energy, for other types of aspects, I mean, for food supplies, for life in general, you know, it's the idea of how do you get certain regions or countries or communities to be able to process and manage those natural resources to benefit their population as well as others, versus being exploited by outside interests. So, you know, it's just like, you know, water is a natural resource that we're not going to become less dependent on water. We need water to live and to take, to stay clean to just everyday life. And the idea there is you don't want necessarily one person controlling it, because if you did, that would create a situation that would, once again, a power thing happening. And so, I mean, I don't know if we will ever become less dependent on natural resources. We'll always be dependent on it. It's the idea of how do we share it in a mutually beneficial way, and not try to have it where we hoard it and we become, and greed steps in, that then, you know, this grabbing for power,
right,
steps in and starts creating tensions.
Yeah,
so, sure. but I don't, you know, I think we've been very blessed with natural resources. To me, it's a God, we are to be good stewards of those natural resources. And by being good stewards of it means taking care of them, but also taking care of each other with it.
I agree. Oh, well, why don't we, agree with you 100%. I do think that, there has to be, you know, a struggle over what the public interest is. It's possible. I mean, some countries have escaped that curse. It's obviously true that in other places, whoever has the most guns and money seizes the wealth, and, you know, then it's, you end up with a bad situation. And also you end up with economies like the earlier countries we were talking about, you know, Saudi Arabia and not so much Iran too before, where it has a some kind of a distorting effect on the social structure, where everything has to happen from the top. I remember when that guy in Libya, I can't remember his name right now, they had a lot of oil. In the beginning, he did.
Gaddafi,
yeah. And in the beginning, he had a lot of support because he just took a lot of the state money and provided some form of health care for everybody in the country, right? And that was, they hadn't had any health care before. So I'm sure they viewed that as a very good thing. And, but then, you know, because it's all in his control, pretty much, right? Or in his, whatever the group that he was ruling on behalf of. And, you know, it can turn around and go straight to hell, you know, too.
Well, I'll give you another case and point directly to us. You know, both of the Iraq wars for us started with actually Saddam attacking Kuwait, if you remember.
Yeah.
And why did Saddam Hussein attack Kuwait, Iraq attack Kuwait? Well, it wasn't just they were just, you know, thinking that like Putin with Ukraine, you know, well, they ought to be part of Russia or, you know, whatever. Or so he didn't say, well, Kuwait ought to be part of Iraq. What was happening is Kuwait was selling oil on the market. You know, they were pumping a lot of oil and selling it on the market at a cheap rate.
Yeah.
Driving down the cost of oil that Iraq needed in order to fund their war against Iran.
Right.
And you can remember we were allies with Iraq at one time against Iran, because Iran has, you know, traditionally been an adversary to America ever since the Iran hostage crisis, mm-hmm. During Carter administration and Reagan, and right, even before, right? And Iran, and so Saddam was keeping Iran busy, but Kuwait was pumping this oil, and Saddam said, you know, wait a minute, stop. America says we don't have anything to do with this. And so Saddam said, well, then we're going to take over your oil wells. And he went across the border and said, stop, you know. Yeah. And all right, of a sudden that prompted an international outcry, and
oh, yeah,
and that the Iraqi war. So, you know, oil has created a lot of wars over the years. Now, the one thing they say is we're going to come to a day when water will start creating wars, where access to water. I mean, Hong Kong was a British colony and could have remained that way forever, as far as the island and the peninsula. But the reason why the British had to hand over Hong Kong to China in 1997 is because the lease on the new territories outside of Hong Kong, which is part of the territory, but they leased it for 99 years from China. The lease was up in 1997, and China was not going to renew the lease. Okay. Right. But what was on that in the new territory? It was the water reserves for the island and peninsula. And so even if British gave back the new territories and kept the crown jewel of the island, Hong Kong,
they wouldn't have any money or water.
They wouldn't have any water.
Right. Right.
And so they couldn't sustain it.
Right.
And so there you go. I mean, that major decision came down to a natural resource.
It's true.
That's how important natural resources are.
Well,
and I told you that Japan attacked China during World War II and because of the fact that they were an island that didn't have natural resources, and China did, and they needed those natural resources in order to survive. And so therefore, by taking over and colonizing or trying to colonize China, that would solve that problem. But so natural resources have been a big issue, and that's one of the reasons why we're talking about Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Oh, it's going to raise the price of gas before an election. That could determine the outcome of a U.S. election.
cause us to go into a major inflation.
Well, have to invade Texas. I don't know to take care of that situation. But the other thing, one last point before we close, is that you mentioned the Japanese invaded China. I've been listening to this wonderful program on Amazon Prime called The Eastern Civilization, and the guy that teaches, he's a good professor, great lecturer. Anyway, but he says, well, when the Chinese came into China in the context that you just described, he says they could have been revenged for the 12th century when China sent, 100,000 people and almost an equal number of boats, although I don't think the boats were much bigger than a Dutch shoe, but nonetheless, to invade Japan, and it failed only because of bad weather in the Sea of Japan. And the boats weren't quite up to it, okay? And so, but other than that, Japan would have been completely overrun. And it was shortly after that that the Japanese shogunates and, the samurai culture, a little more martial orientation picked up. So it might have been...
Well, let me leave you this real quick, John. Okay. And I know we're running out of time, but let me leave this for you to think about. So Hong Kong was created out of the Opium Wars. And the Opium Wars happened because the British merchants were selling drugs, opiates, to the Chinese. And these opium dens were being all over China. And the emperor said, hey, you know what? Our labor force is being decimated by this
by
drug.
Opium. Yeah,
let's kick out these merchants that are selling these drugs to us. Yeah. He did. And he went back to Parliament and said, hey, they kicked us out. British says, well, they can't kick us out. We're a mighty empire. They sent over boats and everything else, fought the Chinese, got Hong Kong as part of the Opium Wars, winning against the war against China. Now, let me ask you this. Where's most of the drugs coming to America and the rest of the Western world?
I thought it was Afghanistan. No?
No. No, you look at fentanyl. Look at where fentanyl and all this other. You look it up, and if you want to see, it's China. I'm just saying, okay, your analogy of the Chinese tried to attack Japan, centuries before. Let's look at history. Let's look at history and see. Right. Okay, how is China attacking us?
I don't know how they're attacking us.
When
we get into attacks, they got two foreign military.
We got drugs. We got people addicted.
Okay, well, I think that's worth negotiating about. But we have 700 foreign military installations. They have two. You're not going to convince the rest of the world that I don't think. And China's making big progress in the global south right now.
Well, John, you're still looking at the physical military facilities. I'm looking at other aspects of, you know, cyber attacks, you know, the well, idea of you know, the import of drugs and other things into the labor force. Like I said, you know, the way the British sold opium to the Chinese, and those opium dens set up and decimated their labor force back, you know, during that time. It's happening on our front here. Now our labor force is being decimated by drugs and addiction.
All right. I think we've come to the end. It's a great discussion. I love talking to you, John. I really do. You know, and I want to thank you,
so much for joining me. Karen wasn't able to join us.
Well, she tried to get in twice, and I think she's in her car or something, or she's in Delaware. So I saw her try to get in twice, but it didn't work. Well, we'll do it again sometime anyway. Yeah, you should. Karen's got, she has her own point of view about everything around here. So, and she was a celebrity in our town for many years in Shepherdstown. So anyway, I love having her on too. And her very talented daughters. I think her, Lucia is working as the West Virginia River, oh no, well, West Virginia E-Council's lobbyist in the state legislature now. which is interesting. All right.
Well, let's see. Have a very interesting take on our natural resources.
West Virginia River's leader. I can't remember her name. Andrea. Is that her name? She's a competent person, but, anyway,
I don't know.
All right, everybody, you've been listening to the Winners and Losers radio program on Friday here. And, my guest, John Unger today, former senator and pastor in of three churches in Harpers Ferry, my community here. I'd love to hear your take on another show about the impact of pastoral work on your spirit, you know, spending so much time with comforting the people who are in distress or in grief. And you know, I had a good friend from years ago that was in your occupation, and it really got to him after a while. And so I was, at some point, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. But in the meantime, as we used to say on the end of my program, it's late, but everything comes next. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thank you.